Welcome to the Science Podcast for September 13th, 2013. I'm Christy Hamilton.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, the role of DNA identification in disaster zones, the latest immunological weapons in the fight against HIV, and Voyager's last exit from the solar system.
And what Voyager 1 saw was a tremendous jump in the density of plasma, jumped up by a factor of 80. And such dense plasma had never been seen inside the heliosphere.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
During the last 30 years, DNA profiling has given countless damaged human remains an identity. Without this technique, these people would have been lost to history, an eternal question mark written upon their fates. Yet access to DNA identification is not equally distributed around the globe. So, in what contexts might a need for large-scale profiling arise? How does the capacity to carry out such identifications differ around the world? Alex John London provides some answers.
The two most common contexts are in the aftermath of conflicts and natural or man-made disasters, and the capacity to conduct DNA identifications in these contexts differs fairly dramatically across the globe. For example, after the conflict in the former Yugoslavia, the international community supported the formation of the International Commission on Missing Persons, which has used DNA to facilitate the identification of more than 16,000 persons. Other efforts have been carried out in the Americas, such as in Argentina, for example, but comparable efforts haven't really been mounted after conflicts in Asia or Africa. The conflict in the Western Balkans also is a very clear illustration of the importance of DNA identification technologies. So there, victims were stripped of identifying documents before they were killed. Their bodies were dumped into mass graves, and then in an effort to hide their crimes from international authorities, perpetrators went back with heavy equipment and dug up those graves so that the bodies could actually be moved and reburied. So the remains were so badly decayed and commingled that DNA was really the only viable method to recover their identities. And after disasters, bodies can also be badly burned or crushed or decayed and displaced. And this occurred after the 2004 Asian tsunami, where international efforts were made to identify victims in Thailand, but not in some other affected areas.
So where is the push for large-scale forensic identification coming from? Is it from the international community, political groups, the families of missing persons?
It really varies in different cases, but most often the push is led by the families of the missing. And there's a lot of reasons why identification can be extremely important to those families. For instance, uncertainty about the status of a loved one can be the source of really paralyzing anguish. I mean, after a conflict, families may wonder whether their relative is dead or whether he or she is alive somewhere, perhaps in a prison camp or a labor camp. After the Asian tsunami, there were concerns that children would be preyed on by human traffickers. So families of the missing might anguish over the thought that their child might be dead or that their child might have survived only to be trafficked. And families want information about their loved one. They want to know how they died, where were they. They want the return of their remains so that they can perform funerary rites and so that they can have some social recognition of the passing of their loved one. But very often what families also want is justice. They want perpetrators to be held accountable. They want crimes against humanity to be recognized and confronted so that they don't happen again. And sometimes they also want transitional justice in that they think that uncovering the truth of an event and who was responsible for what is an important stage in social healing and reconciliation.
Right. And separate from the emotional turmoil, there are also legal troubles that can arise when families are unable to declare a death in the family. Can you discuss how so?
Yeah, it's easy to overlook how the identification of remains contributes in diverse ways to systems of accountability that are enshrined in criminal and civil law. And it's easy to overlook how confirmation of status is often necessary for families to exercise a range of social and legal rights. In many places, extended families depend on a single breadwinner for financial support. And so the inability to confirm the death of that person can bar them from access to compensation or financial aid. So, for example, there are news reports that the victims of the April 2013 collapse of the Rana Plaza factory building in Bangladesh won't be eligible for governmental compensation for the death of their loved one if they can't establish that their loved one is dead. Confirmation of death may be important to establishing the standing of the family to take legal action against parties who are responsible for a loved one's death. And similarly, without confirmation of death, it may be unclear whether a person is married or a widow or a widower. And with that status comes the right to inherit property or to remarry. So depending on the social norms where a person lives and on their social and economic status, identification of a missing loved one can have really broad ramifications for their social status and their economic situation.
I thought the example you gave of how wives are affected in Bosnia and Nepal was really powerful. For them, to legally note the difference between death and missing has huge lifestyle consequences. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. In Bosnia, confirmation of death was necessary to establish the legal right to various benefits, like pensions. And there was a mechanism in place early on for gathering information about missing men and trying to use eyewitness accounts to confirm their death and then issue death certificates. But some women refused to accept a death certificate that was issued without forensic proof of their loved one's death. And the reason is that there were rumors at the time that men who were believed to have been massacred at Srebrenica, for example, were really alive and they were languishing in Bosnian Serb labor camps. So in that case, there was a strong push for DNA because it was the only form of forensic identification that could be used to confirm the death. In Nepal, wives of men missing from the conflict there sometimes are unable to remarry or live independently because they're culturally bound to behave as married women. So as a result, they become dependent on the relatives of their missing husbands for support, and this can create really strained social dynamics where these women are vulnerable to impoverishment, neglect, and abuse, and where they face increasing isolation in their communities.
So is there a stigma there?
Most certainly. Part of it is not really occupying a specific social role. You know, are you a widow or are you still the spouse of this other person?
So what kinds of concerns may some family members have about submitting DNA to governments to establish kinship of a missing or dead relative?
Some DNA identification efforts are carried out by governments, but some are carried out by non-governmental entities, by international bodies, and you know, these different entities have different authority or legal ability to safeguard the information of participants. So families may be concerned about the security of their genetic information and about whether authorities are going to use that information for ends other than identifying the missing. So for example, they might worry that DNA databases could be used to identify political activists and their families, or that they might be made subject to special policing if authorities use the database to conduct criminal investigations. These databases can also reveal discrepancies between reported kinship relationships between donors and their actual genetic relatedness. So I might come in and say that this other person who's going to donate DNA is my son, and it could be revealed then that they're not really my biological child. And in places where infidelity is a crime or where women are held responsible for pregnancies that result from rape, women may worry that such databases could be used by authorities to enforce legal or social norms of fidelity and propriety. Now, that's one of the reasons that we argue that there need to be very strong protections for the privacy of donors that are backed by some legal force, that's critical to maintaining trust in the identification process and to preventing it from being co-opted and abused.
Right. So that's one barrier. Are there others for implementing such a large-scale identification effort?
Really, infrastructure, funding, and political will. You know, communities are set up to handle a certain load of forensic cases. Conflicts and disasters pose special challenges in part because they create an influx of bodies that have to be identified, and this can overwhelm local forensic capacity. As a result, whether efforts are made to identify victims then depends on whether the relevant authorities have the resources and the political will to fund those efforts, or on the willingness of international donors to step in and fill the gap. So as a result, access to identification technology is somewhat ad hoc. although efforts were made to identify the victims of the tsunami in Thailand, as I said before, you know, similar efforts weren't really made in Sri Lanka or Indonesia, where there wasn't as high of a density of Western tourists.
So the science is available, but the political will and infrastructure is not as strong. What can be done to improve things?
So we argue that what's needed is an international structure that has the funding and the mandate to make forensic identification capacity available to communities on terms other than their ability to pay. This could be a single organization. It could be a network of organizations. So we're less concerned about its specific structure than about its function, that we think that it should be mandated to bring to bear institutional knowledge about how to handle complex logistical challenges of large-scale identification efforts, that it should be mandated to ensure that best practices are used so that identifications are reliable, and it should have the legal standing to provide robust protections to the privacy and confidentiality of participants in the process. And our hope is that such a structure would more efficiently and effectively promote a range of humanitarian and human rights goals.
Well, Alex John London, thanks for talking with me.
It's been my pleasure.
Alex John London writes about equal access to DNA identification in a policy forum in this week's issue.
Despite 30 years of research, there is no HIV vaccine, and the virus's seemingly infinite mutability gave little hope for this tactic. But as Michelle Newsom-Swag writes in a review this week, antibodies isolated from HIV patients may serve as a good starting point for a new immunological approach to battling HIV.
There are several features that make HIV difficult for the immune system to deal with, beginning with what everybody knows about, which is that it's so variable and is constantly mutating. So it's always finding variants that might evade an ongoing immune response. And those variants can be selected by the immune system. So that's one thing, is variability. And the second thing is that the target for the immune system, at least the target on the surface of the virus for antibodies, is something that's highly glycosylated, and the glycosylation can also vary to shield the protein elements away from the antibody. And finally, the third element that makes it difficult to deal with is that the number of HIV spikes that are on the surface of the virus are very, very small. So it's a variable, well-hidden, and elusive target.
And what are the spikes? What are HIV spikes?
Spikes are the proteins on the surface of the virus that bind the human cells to enter the human cells.
Your review focuses on the potential of neutralizing antibodies. Can you talk about how those are different from a binding antibody?
Well, I'm not sure that I know the answer to that one. And I'm not sure that anybody really knows. It may be that any antibody that can bind to the envelope spike on a virus, on a viable virus, will have an effect and will block in some way or help eliminate the virus. There are experiments that have been done, they were done a long time ago, introducing peptides into the envelope spike and showing that antibodies to those peptides would neutralize the virus. So it may be that anything that can get in there would work.
Why do you call them neutralizing antibodies specifically?
They're called neutralizing antibodies based on their in vitro activities mainly, and in vivo activities, and ability to prevent the virus from entering cells.
Mm-hmm. What has led researchers to think that these might be useful in fighting HIV?
Okay, there's several things. First thing is that if you transfer them into macaques, and this is something that's been known for quite some time, they prevent infection. So that's a pretty good measure of the fact that something like this will stop HIV from being able to infect. That's one thing. And then the other thing, which is far more recent, is that the antibodies appear to be able to suppress or control infection in mouse models.
Mm-hmm. Some recent developments have actually allowed for more thorough investigation of these antibodies as tools. What's changed?
What's changed is the ability to clone them from human beings. Up until about 4 years ago, it was very difficult to obtain these antibodies, and there were very, very few that had been characterized. There were really only four. And the reason there were really only four is that the techniques available to clone human antibodies were very limited and difficult. So the introduction of methods that made this cloning relatively straightforward basically opened up the field. And now there are dozens and dozens and dozens of these antibodies that have been obtained from human beings that have serologic activity that neutralizes the virus.
What features do these newly isolated antibodies have in common that might help explain their activity?
Well, what they have in common is that they're very, very highly somatically mutated. That is the most common feature that is across the board for just about all of them. That is probably a reflection of the fact that it takes quite a bit of time and a lot of trial and effort by the immune system in order to produce these antibodies. And that is consistent with the finding that individuals that harbor these antibodies usually do so after being infected for quite a long period of time, up to 2 or 3 years.
So what does somatic mutation mean in this context?
Okay, so antibodies are products of B cells. B cells are born in the bone marrow, and they assemble their antibodies from gene segments so that there's a tremendous amount of diversity. Now, when an antigen like HIV comes into the system, the B cell with the right receptor, or one that sees HIV from that large collection of what's there to begin with, is selected, and that clone is expanded in structures called germinal centers. During the expansion phase, the B lymphocytes mutate their antibody genes. They make variants of the starting clone by changing the nucleotide structure of the antibody. Single point mutations are introduced. And during this reaction, the best cell, the cell with the highest affinity, is selected. Normally, you get one round of germinal center reaction, and you make a very high affinity antibody, and that's what you go with. In this case, there is a lot more somatic mutation in the antibodies, almost as if they've had to try and try and try again in order to get to this place where they are broadly neutralizing.
Okay, great. That was very helpful. Now that these antibodies have been isolated and studied for a bit, how might these results be translated into the clinic? Are there mechanisms for getting them into people who need them?
So we don't know what they're going to do in humans yet, and the only way to find out is to try it. And there are mechanisms. So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, together with the Howard Hughes Institute and Rockefeller University, are sponsoring the initiation of clinical trials to put these reagents into people to see whether or not they will be a benefit.
Mm-hmm. What might be a way of getting these antibodies into a person, though?
Right. So there are two ways. The simplest way is to just inject them. The hard way is to make the person make them themselves by a vaccine. Mm-hmm. Making it by a vaccine would be the ultimate goal of this kind of research. It means trying to find the pathway that created the antibodies to begin with, defining that pathway, and then trying to reproduce it.
Really interesting. So you end your review with a series of open questions. What do you see as the important steps to take next?
I think that trying these antibodies in humans is very important to try to get an idea of what their potential is in terms of changing the course of the disease.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Nussenswag, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michelle Nussenswag and colleagues write about a new tactic for developing HIV vaccines as part of a special section on antibodies in this week's issue. In this section, you can also read reviews on using antibodies to treat cancer and recent advances in the understanding of memory B cells, the cells responsible for creating antibodies.
A study published this week may finally bring an end to a heated debate. Based on new measurements on the plasma densities around Voyager 1, the Voyager mission team has concluded that the spacecraft has officially left our solar system for good. Looking back at the year-long debate, senior writer Richard Kerr reports on the challenges of coming up with a unanimous verdict on the whereabouts of Voyager.
Voyager 1 has been heading out of the solar system ever since it passed by Saturn in 1980. And the next objective for Voyager 1 was probing the outer edge of the solar system. To space physicists, this is the outer edge of the so-called heliosphere. This is the bubble that's blown up by the sun's solar wind. And it was presumed to be out there somewhere, perhaps 100, perhaps 200 times farther from the sun than the Earth is. So the question was, where is it and what is it going to be like?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the results from Voyager 1 that were reported a year ago in August were a bit confusing. And so scientists have been debating whether Voyager 1 passed out of the heliosphere in the summer of 2012 or whether it has yet to pass out of the heliosphere.
So this week, we might have the answers to that. Can you briefly summarize the data being published in this week's issue and what they tell us about the location of the Voyager spacecraft?
Well, these results are brand new and rather stunning. The Voyager 1 spacecraft had reported dramatic changes in cosmic rays in August 2012. And cosmic ray specialists especially took that as crossing into interstellar space.
Mm-hmm.
But Voyager failed to return any sign of a change in the direction of the magnetic field. And theorists had been expecting a change in the direction of the magnetic field. Now, a third kind of evidence has been returned by Voyager, and that is a measurement of how dense the plasma is where Voyager 1 is. Mm-hmm. Plasma is a soup of charged and neutral particles that pervades the solar system and all of space. And what Voyager 1 saw was a tremendous jump in the density of plasma, jumped up by a factor of 80. And such dense plasma had never been seen inside the heliosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And it was expected to jump up like that once Voyager 1 entered into interstellar space. So the conclusion of this paper this week in Science is, yes, Voyager 1 has entered interstellar space, and through a bit of backtracking, they conclude that it did, in fact, enter interstellar space in August of 2012.
So the conclusion was actually reported a year ago, like you said, but the Voyager mission team couldn't really confirm that with the data available. So why has it been so challenging in the past for scientists to conclusively say if Voyager has left our solar system?
Well, the edge of the solar system, the heliosphere, perhaps no big surprise, turns out to be more complicated than expected. And Voyager 1 was further handicapped by lacking a key instrument which would have directly measured the density of plasma and would have supplied one of the key signals that it had crossed into interstellar space. So there was the strong sign in the cosmic rays, but then there was the absence of a change in the magnetic field. Different specialists saw that different ways. Lacking the plasma density, the Voyager team leaders decided to go with, kind of a middle road, something they called the magnetic highway, which was a special region just before the outer boundary of the heliosphere. And that was their consensus as early as last December. But now they have gone over to Voyager, having crossed out of the solar system with this new data.
As you mentioned, there are so many different scientists involved in this debate, and they're in different fields, there are different universities and organizations, and they're each coming to a slightly different conclusion. So what part does the science steering group play in sorting through these studies?
Well, the science steering group is composed of the principal investigators of the instruments that are still working on Voyager. Many of them have broken or require too much power. And so these five scientists with specialties in different areas, cosmic rays, plasma waves, magnetic fields, they try to take all the evidence into consideration and come up with a consensus view. Does not mean that every one of them wholeheartedly endorses the consensus view, but that's the view they come to.
Mm-hmm. Now, we actually had one of the principal investigators on our podcast back in June, Edward Stone, and he indicated a key sign of Voyager leaving is a change in the direction of the magnetic field, which we haven't detected yet. So why do these new measurements on the plasma density trump those on the magnetic field?
Well, it was a bit of a balancing act. You had the positive cosmic ray evidence and the negative magnetic field evidence. And now there's a third kind of evidence. And in the minds of Voyager principal investigators, that has tipped the scales. And so thinking fairly broadly is, well, Voyager is out, and the theorists are going to have to find a way to explain this odd magnetic field data.
Mm-hmm. So even though we do have a consensus from the Voyager mission team, we still don't really have a unanimous one in the scientific community as a whole. So there are a handful of experts who believe that the Voyager hasn't actually left yet. So who are they, and how do they interpret the data in the study?
Well, there's a variety of scientists who aren't yet totally convinced. Some are still stymied by lack of a change in direction of the magnetic field, mm-hmm. and that makes them very uneasy. But there are others who think they have a better interpretation of what Voyager has been returning. There's a pair of the University of Michigan who interpret everything a little differently and think they can explain this odd set of observations with something relatively simple as these solar wind piling up at the edge of the heliosphere. And that's what has generated this enhanced density of plasma. Could be, mm-hmm. or not. Voyager 2, a twin to Voyager 1, is also heading for interstellar space. It's a few years away from getting to the edge, but it has a working plasma instrument and could confirm or deny some of these alternative interpretations.
Mm-hmm. So can we really say that this debate is finally settled, or is this just another piece to the puzzle?
Well, I would say it's tentatively settled or mm-hmm. provisionally settled. Plenty for Voyager 1 and 2 to explore yet, and perhaps given a few more years, a magnetic field direction change will show up, or perhaps Voyager 2 will settle things when it gets to wherever Voyager 1 was in the summer of 2012. And it looks good for that. Both Voyagers have decreasing amounts of electrical power available as their power sources run down. But Voyager 1 has enough power to run its current instruments until 2020. Then they'll have to start power sharing, turning instruments on and off in order to make use of ever smaller amount of power available. And it's not until 2025 when Voyager 1 will have to be shut down totally.
Mm-hmm. Well, Richard Kerr, thanks so much.
Certainly, my pleasure.
Richard Kerr reports on the uncertainties surrounding Voyager's departure from our solar system in this week's Science.
Also this week in Science. In addition to a special section on antibodies, this week's issue features research on how climate change might contribute to human conflict, a bug that uses toothed gears for jumping, and from the news section, a story on the latest moon mission. You can check out all these stories and more at www.sciencemag.org. Finally today, Adrian Cho, staff writer for Science Magazine and Science Now, is here to talk about some recent stories from our daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. So Adrian, first up, we have a story on reprogramming cells in vivo. Researchers have been able to reprogram cells, take them back to a stem cell-like state since like 2006, but always in a dish, never inside a living animal until now. So let's start with making pluripotent cells in a dish. How is that done?
Well, so the breakthrough there was that researchers discovered that you only had to manipulate four genes to actually take an adult cell, like a skin cell, and make it revert to its kind of primordial form, the so-called pluripotent form, where the cell can then differentiate into any different type of cell within the body. So they figured out that they could do this just by manipulating essentially four genes. And that's how it was done in petri dishes. So what's happened now is that researchers have found that they can actually do this inside a living organism. So researchers at the National Cancer Research Center in Madrid used genetically modified mice that had these four key genes in them. The mice were designed in such a way that these genes could be manipulated by giving the mice certain drugs. And so what they showed is that in these mice, they could turn on these genetic switches, essentially, and make cells within the fully grown mouse go back to their pluripotent stem cell form. In fact, they showed something more than that. They showed that the cells actually go back to an even more variable type of stem cell called a totipotent stem cell. And the difference here is a little bit specialized. A pluripotent stem cell can turn into any cell in, you know, the normal grown body, but only totipotent stem cells can form special tissues like placenta.
They were actually able to induce these cells inside of a mouse. How did that actually turn out for the mice?
It probably was not a great experience for the mice. So the mice broke out in these tumors, and they were very weird tumors. They had placental cells and things like that inside them. So they were very, very strange tumors. Mm-hmm. One researcher described this advance, a researcher not involved in the work, described this advance as a bit creepy.
Right, because they were growing, what was it called, tetraromas? There are many kinds of cells all in the tumor.
Right.
What's the next step for this research?
Well, so the next step is they're actually going to put human cells within a mouse, so a living organism, and see if they can induce the human cells back into their pluripotent state as well. Looking long into the future, this advance raises some possibility that maybe at some point in the future, scientists would be able to reprogram cells within a human being and actually use them to help regenerate damaged tissues, essentially repairing the body from the inside out.
Next up, we have a story on the tingly feeling of Szechuan peppers. Szechuan peppers create a unique feeling in the mouth. It kind of starts out as heat and then turns into this weird numbing, tingling feeling. And now a group of researchers is suggesting this might actually be because the peppers stimulate nerve fibers associated with touch. What kind of fibers are we talking about here?
So these are nerve fibers known as RA1 fibers. They're mechanoreceptors. So they are the kind of thing that sense mechanical movement. You know, if you run your hand across a corduroy, it has a particular distinctive feel, and these are the type of nerve cells that are triggered to help you get that sense of sensation of the texture. And so this was a kind of odd experiment. This tingling sensation has been known, and the researchers wanted to know if the tingling sensation had something to do with exciting these nerves, these mechanoreceptor nerves. So they did a kind of curious experiment where they would put the Szechuan pepper on the lips of a subject and then hook the subject's finger to a little gizmo that would vibrate, and then they would tune the vibration until the subject would say that the frequency matched the frequency of the tingling on the lips and tongue. Huh. And when they did this, they found that apparently Szechuan pepper has a frequency of about 50 cycles per second, which is a little bit less than, you know, if you walk into a room with bad fluorescent lights and you hear that buzz, that's a 60 cycle per second buzz from the electricity. So it's a little bit slower than that. And these particular RA1 fibers are known to react to a frequency of around 50 cycles per second. So the authors inferred that the chemical in Szechuan pepper is actually stimulating these nerve cells as well, and that's why you get this characteristic frequency.
This doesn't seal it up, though. I mean, it could still be that other nerve fibers are contributing to the sensation as well?
That's right. Other researchers point out that this seems to make a pretty strong case that they are exciting the RA1 nerve fibers, but there are other nerve fibers that react to different stimuli or to broad groups of stimuli, and they could be exciting those as well.
Mm-hmm. So I thought this was a really neat study because it's looking at Szechuan peppers and this food, and you're looking at senses, but that's actually something that's been done with a couple of other different tastes. What other tastes have been helpful in investigating the senses?
Neuroscientists have used menthol in chili peppers to help understand sensations like pain and temperature. One can imagine, you know, the cooling sensation of menthol on the tongue. So this is kind of in line with that. In fact, along these lines, this paper raises a kind of interesting possibility, according to one researcher. He envisions that an artist or a cook could come up with some sort of experience where you combine sound and sight and the taste of Szechuan pepper. You know, you've got vibrations going at the same frequency that you're tasting to have a sort of multi-dimensional experience, which sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, I would try it. Why not?
Finally, we have a story on faster switching LCDs. So LCDs, or liquid crystal displays, are behind most of the screens we stare at day in and day out. Can you give us a quick recap of how these basically common household items work?
Sure. Liquid crystal display takes advantage of the weird properties of liquid crystals, which are bona fide liquids, right? The molecules in them jumble around and move and flow. But the liquid crystals also have some properties like a solid. In particular, the molecules are usually kind of rod-shaped, and they all tend to point in the same direction, like the molecules in a molecular crystal. And that gives it very weird optical properties. In particular, it turns out that if you shine polarized light through a liquid crystal, depending on how the molecules are lined up, they can turn the polarization, almost like reaching in and turning the hand of a grandfather clock. The reason that that's helpful in a display is you can start out with the display, the light's coming from the back of the display towards your eyes, and in the display there are two polarizers, which will only let light through if it's polarized in a particular direction, and they're actually at right angles. So by default, the light can't get through it. The light that gets through the back of the display, the polarizer at the back of the display, can't get through the polarizer at the front, until you put the liquid crystal in between, and then you set things up just right so that if you apply an electric field, you rotate all these molecules, and they then rotate the polarization of the light to an extent that it'll get through to the front of the screen and then come out and hit your eye. So when you watch a video on an LCD display, like something, say, in a smartphone, what's actually happening is that there are all these little electrical signals that are either rotating the liquid crystal molecules or not, you know, just leaving them where they are, so that the pixels light up and turn off and form an image.
And so how quickly can these crystals actually be flipped around?
So there's an asymmetry here. You can wrench the molecules into the position where the light comes through in a standard display very quickly in just tens of nanoseconds. But what happens when you turn the electric field off is that it takes about, you know, 1,000 times longer for the molecules to relax back to their original orientation. And that's because that orientation is set by a pattern etched into the screen itself, and it takes time for the subtle effect to sort of propagate through all these molecules. It's almost like, you know, moving a crowd of people, right? If you sort of give them a little shove, it takes a while for that shove to propagate through the crowd.
And so what do the researchers here do to speed things along?
So here they did a kind of twist, if you will, on a liquid crystal display. They found a clever way to return to the default position. They did it using a slightly different effect. They started out with the molecules oriented so that the light actually gets through, right? So the default position is that the light is going to come through the cell. And then they applied an electric field. But in this case, instead of turning the molecules, what it does is it actually makes them even more ordered than they usually are. And these molecules are elongated, but they're not actually like cylindrical rods. They're a little bit more like planks, okay? Mm-hmm. And what happens is normally the planks are just kind of, they all point in the same direction, but they're all twisted in different orientations, and they keep twisting because of thermal motion, and there's this kind of disorder if you look in how they're all twisted. twisted around their long axes.
Okay, so it's they're all, say, pointing the long way towards one thing, but they might be, different edges might be facing you.
Bingo. Okay. That's exactly right. And so then what they do is they apply an electric field that doesn't twist the direction of the long direction, but what it does is that it overcomes this kind of jiggling that's got them twisting edgewise, and it makes them stack a little bit like lumber. And it turns out that if you do that, it changes in a subtle way the amount that the liquid crystal rotates the light, and less of it gets through, so the cell gets slightly dimmer. And the advantage is, as soon as you turn that field off, the jiggling just comes back and undoes this sort of extra step of ordering that you've put in, and so the thing turns off very quickly in something like 30 nanoseconds. So the disadvantage is that the effect is relatively smaller, but the advantage is that it's very fast.
So is this going to give us high-speed televisions?
Well, so this is not actually likely to make it into your smartphone or your computer screen or your television. Frankly, your eye can't respond anything, to anything close to that speed. 30 nanoseconds is way, way, way too fast for your eye.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the kind of speed that you need for a display that's going to feed the eye. However, it may allow you to do other things with liquid crystals, right? You may be able to make, ultra-fast shutters that can come on and off very quickly.
Mm.
You may be able to direct laser beams that used in communications, say, between satellites very quickly if you can use very fast-switching LCDs and change the contrast very quickly. So it's not going to replace the technology that you've got sitting on your desk every day, but it has potential for other uses. And I think the really interesting thing is it's a new twist on the whole idea of an LCD.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Adrian?
Well, there's a paper that shows that birds with bigger brains have lower levels of stress hormones, suggesting that smarter birds know how to cope with the trials of day-to-day living better than dumber birds. And scientists have also decoded the DNA from a cave bear that lived 300,000 years ago, and that makes it the oldest DNA ever found outside of the Arctic, where the ice keeps DNA frozen, keeps it from degrading. This bests the previous best record for DNA found outside the Arctic, which was 120,000 years. Also, on our policy blog, Science Insider, our writer Jennifer Cousin-Frankel has been to a conference of the International Congress of Peer Review and Biomedical Publication in Chicago and has filed 4 reports about what's going on there. For example, there's a study of what happens when papers are retracted, and are they really retracted, looking at the oeuvre of one researcher who was found guilty of misconduct. 88 of his papers were supposed to be retracted. 9 of them were not. Only 5 of them met the full criteria for what really should happen when you retract a paper. So apparently, peer review, as always, is a bit of a work in progress.
Great. Thanks, Adrian.
My pleasure.
Adrian Cho is a staff writer for Science Magazine and Science's daily news site, Science Now. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. And that concludes the September 13th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Christy Hamilton. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.